traveling music.
I've been everywhere, man. I've been everywhere, man. Across the deserts bare, man. I breathe the mountain air, man. Of travel I've had my share, man. I've been everywhere.
Seemed like appropriate music to introduce our next guest, Bob Ryan of the Boston Globe, who has a wonderful piece out. It is online right now and will be in the print edition this weekend. Bob, thank you so much for being with us.
Well, thank you very much for having me. I appreciate it.
You managed to complete the journey, I would say, the journey of a lifetime, one that started back in New Jersey many years ago and wrapped up in South Dakota.
I want to correct a misimpression that we hope will be corrected electronically and then by Sunday. You'll see a tag that says it was the quest. It was a lifelong. No, this just happened organically. I never even thought about this till I hit state like 48, and I realized what state 48 was. Mississippi, Ole Miss football game, and then 49 was my 50th state in which I was able to get into and sleep in. That was Alaska, and once I hit 49, I said, "Wow! How about that? It'd be cool to do 50." And that's how it came about. So that this thought in my head is only about a year, a couple of years old. And so anyway, I just want to correct that misimpression. Yeah, I didn't set out, 55 years ago to do all 50 states. It just kind of happened.
But a whole lot of this goes back to your childhood and your parents and their support of a young man that absolutely loves sports and loved being around sports.
Yeah, so I was. And the DNA is so obvious. My father was involved in local sports in Trenton, New Jersey, in various capacities, including working for the Trenton Giants of the Class B Interstate League in the late 40s and a Giant affiliate. And so I was being taken to games. I was an only child. I was being taken to games, and I know I was there. I'm told, how do I know, but I was always brought up to believe I was there when Willie Mays made his major organized baseball debut in Trenton at Dunfield in 1950. And so I know I was going to ball games from the time I was, before I could even walk. And then that's where it got started. Then the college love was implanted when my father was spending 2 years at Villanova as the assistant athletic director, and I was introduced into big time college football and basketball. And that and it's just interesting, Rich, that when I was doing the preparation for this story and annotating how many states I've seen each of the various sports, that it was no surprise that the winners were college basketball with 38. And minor league baseball with 31. Those were my foundation sports. That's how I got started, many, many years ago.
And you talk about some of the highlights of this journey, and I love so many of the stories, but I want to go back to 1957 and a memorable game between Army and Notre Dame.
Absolutely. Well, my father had passed away in the previous May, and I was 11. It was traumatic, obviously. And my mother was savvy with this whole sports thing, and she knew what she had on her hands. As I said in the story, she was a widow of one sports nut, and she was the mother of another. And she arranged, she got the tickets for the Army Notre Dame game in the following September. Now, for those of you, some people sure do know the history, which was that was a great rivalry that had begun in 1913 when Notre Dame was famously upset Army with Newt Rockne and DeRais. And they then played annually throughout the 20s, 30s, and 40s until 1947. And that the series ended. There was some acrimony. I don't know what the story was, but they stopped. They ceased playing each other. It was a big national event every year. Well, they resumed it in 1957. And in Philadelphia at Municipal Stadium, and my mother got tickets, and I was at the game. And it was an epic game. Bob Anderson of Army took the first handoff of the game and went 85 yards. But Notre Dame won on a field goal by Monty Stickles, and I still have that ticket stub.
Well, you also, along the way, managed to see Bill Bradley in his first game as a Princeton Tiger.
That's right. And Dillon Gymnasium in Princeton, I was well aware of who this new phenomenon was that Princeton had. Of course, I went to school, in Lawrenceville School, which is equidistant between Trenton and Princeton. And so it was easy to get to Princeton for the game. And he got 27 points against a box-and-one defense put on there by Lafayette. But I was present for Bradley's first college game, yes.
And we were talking with Gary Tangway earlier in the show, and he said, Bob may have told you already, but make sure he tells the story about seeing Bird and Magic for the first time.
Well, Providence was playing Michigan State in 1979 in the first round NCAA game, and I was assigned to cover for the Globe. And that was on a Saturday afternoon in Indianapolis. On Friday night, it just so happened that Indiana State was going to be home playing an NIT game against Illinois State. This is the 78-79 season. So, 77-78 season, excuse me. Mike Madden, who was a friend from Providence Journal, and Jason Stark, who's gone on to great fame and glory as a baseball writer, they both were working for Providence, and three of us drove out. I drove them. We drove out to Terre Haute, and we saw Larry Bird. And I'll tell you right now, it was epic. The game starts, and Illinois State misses a shot, and Bird gets the rebound. And he's proceeding down the left-hand side of the court, and just as he hits midcourt, he rocks his hand back. Off the dribble, he throws a bullet 40-foot pass to Carl Nix for a layup. That's the first time I ever saw him touch the ball, and he makes a spectacular pass. And so we're driving back after the game, and we're commiserating, we stopped at a convenient at a service area, and I admit to picking up a brewski. And yes, I was indeed sipping from the brewski, we see the blue lights behind us. Oh my God! So we get pulled over. We were able to ditch the brewskis before the trooper came up. He said, "You boys moving pretty fast." I said, "So, officer, I'm sorry. We were just coming back from the ISU game, and we were talking and kind of got wrapped up." And he said, "Really? Who won?" I said, "Oh, they won. Bird hit the basket to win the game." He said, "You boys be safe now. You boys be careful now." And that was the end of that. And that's a true story.
I love it. Love also that you spent 3 days watching college basketball in Fort Kent, Maine.
Yes. I became aware that that season, it was this winter of 99-2000. And in the fall, in December, I found out that Fort Kent was having a real good season. They were ranked, first time ever. They were ranked in Division III rankings. And I realized where Fort Kent was and knew it was the beginning of Route 1. And I checked it out, and it was I wanted it to be the American educational institution, higher education, with the highest latitude. Well, they were second.
Oh.
The school in Bellingham, Washington, was farther north than Fort Kent. But it'll have to do. So I call up, and Jim Grisham was the AD, and I say, Bob Ryan, Boston Globe, and he immediately says, "Oh, you must have the wrong number. You probably want Orono." I said, "No, I want you." And I said, "I'm interested in your team. I want to come see you guys play." And I said, "Give me a good opponent." He said, "Oh, you want to come for Umpy?" And I said, "Oh, really? What's that?" And he said, "Presque Isle, University of Maine, Presque Isle." So that's how we did it. I went up there, and I spent 3 days up there, and they treated me great, and I had a great time. And what a fascinating team it was, including a 5'6" shooting guard who was of Laotian descent, probably the greatest Laotian basketball player we've ever known. I don't know what happened to him, but he was their shooting guard. So it was a good trip, and it was a fun time.
And then the opposite side of the country to Castledale, Utah, to see young Sean Bradley.
But yeah, that was something. He was this phenomenon, and I was intrigued by the whole prospect of it, and the fact that he was a really legitimate prospect. And so I went out to Castledale, which is 150 miles southwest of Salt Lake City, a little town in Emery County. Emery County is about as big as Rhode Island, and it has no stoplights. And you just drive from one little town to the other, and they all have three things in common. And the three things are the church, the Mormon church, the local one, the Zion National Bank, and the 7-Eleven. No, that's the three things all those towns have in common. And so I spent three days there, and I was at the house of his mother and father's house, and they lived on a ranch that owned by his paternal grandfather. And they were what they were known as the family. They were this direct descendants of people who had made the trek with Joseph Smith, and those people are called pioneer Mormons. So he was a Mormon royalty, really. And it was a fascinating 3 days there, and the story, and he was a great kid, very smart, And of course, as my great line was, he said, you know, a lot of big people, you know, they have trouble with it. I always thought Ralph Sampson would have paid $1 million for an operation to make him 6'4", but Sean embraced it. And he said, but the only problem is it's getting harder and harder to ride a horse.
I love that. That's great. We're talking with Bob Ryan here on Downtown. You mentioned minor league baseball and your journey to some 33 states to watch minor league baseball. I love the story of seeing that loaded Albuquerque team managed by Tommy Lasorda.
Yep. That was something. And they had built this new ballpark it was included. The big feature was that you could park your car from foul pole to foul pole as if it were a drive-in movie, and they parked cars there. Anyway, Tom Lasorda was the manager, and this is before he became Tom Lasorda. You know, this is the guy that only baseball freaks knew the general public didn't know who he was. He was the manager. I'll give you the lineup very quickly. The catcher was Joe Ferguson. The first baseman was Tom Pachurik. Second base was Davey Lopes. Shortstop, Steve Hunts. Third baseman, Ron Say. Left field, Larry Heisel. Center field, Von Joshua. And the right field, a guy named Paul Ray Powell. Starting rotation, the rotation included Jeff Sahn, Doug Rau, and Charlie Huff. This is very possibly the greatest minor league baseball team of the last 60 years, and they didn't quite run through the Pacific Coast League, and so that was a trip. And I, you know, got fully indoctrinated, you know, Lasorda with Dodger blue. He was an incredible loyalist of the organization, and of course we all know how it turned. We all know how it turned out.
And it's not part of your 50 states, but do you even watch minor league baseball in Quebec?
Yes, because in 1972, I was working on a book on minor league baseball, and one of the places I went was Trois-Rivières. They were in the Eastern League. They were a Reds affiliate. And among the players that they had on that roster were Ken Griffey Sr., whether you didn't know he was senior then, but he was, and Dan Dreesen. And I do think that young Ken had been born. So I got to think that he may have been sitting and laying in the crib there while I was there. But the highlight of that one, Rich, was during a rainy afternoon, I interviewed the manager of the Reading Phillies for about 2 hours in his hotel room, Jim Bunning.
And wow.
Before he ran for office and became a congressman and a senator. And one of the things I most remember was him. He was definitely a old school guy who was lamenting the modern generation thing. You know, it was really classic. But he was a hard-nosed guy.
I was out in Fargo, North Dakota this past fall broadcasting University of Maine football. You got to see North Dakota State take on the Jackrabbits of South Dakota State in your 50th state.
That's how it all ended. I ended up in my 50th state was South Dakota. And you have three options in South Dakota. You got South Dakota University football, basketball, South Dakota State football, basketball, and the Sioux Falls Canaries of the American Association Independent League. Well, I wouldn't have minded that one at all, but I decided I got to go see the Jackrabbits take the floor. And of course, they are the two-time defending football champions. But I'm a basketball guy, and I wanted to see them play basketball. So I did, and they were playing North Dakota State, the Bison, a good rival. And it was a couple of really nice days there, and I got a great, great game to put the ribbon on the whole package of the 50 states thing.
And the least surprising part of this entire piece, Bob, was the fact that I learned you saved all these ticket stubs through the years as well.
Well, I have a lot of them. I don't have, you know, I have representative sampling of them. I'm a big believer in that. I lament the change to digital tickets. People aren't going to be able to do this anymore. And I think it's a sad thing. So many people really get great enjoyment. The memories. I've got ticket stubs from a variety of things, but a couple ones that they're posting in the story there's a story behind each of them. But in 1968, 69 winter, I was at Fort Knox at the Army Reserve, and I had a weekend pass, and I went to Lexington and saw Kentucky play in the Memorial Coliseum. This is the Casey Pratt Issel team, a very good team. And that got me in the Memorial Coliseum. And then the other one was in 1970, my wife and I had never been to California. We'd been married less than a year, and I had a February vacation, and she was a teacher, and she had vacation, and we went to California. And of course, I got tickets for a UCLA game. So we arrived in L.A. on Saturday afternoon and threw our bags in the hotel and went over to Pauley Pavilion and got to see UCLA in Washington. I have those stubs.
You've been to so many wonderful venues for sport through the years. Does anything rank higher than the Palestra for you?
No, well, that's grew up there in a sense, you know. And the best basketball experience that I've ever had were in the Palestra in the heyday of it and of the Big Five before it got, you know, the college basketball landscape changed but anyway, it was in the 50s and 60s and 70s. The Palestra was as good as any place that I've ever known. I love that. I was kiddingly say that I wanted to be buried under half court of the Palestra.
And in the article, you talk about five events you would not mind reliving, and that's certainly high on that list. The NBA Eastern Conference Finals 1981. What made that matchup so intense between the Celtics and the 76ers?
Well, the first thing is that the Celtics and 76ers, Philadelphia rivalry, whether it was the Warriors back in the Wilt and Russell days or whether it was the 76ers in the Larry Bird and Julius Irving days, was a great heated rivalry. It had a lot of history to it. By that time, it had been going on for 25 years. So all the Philadelphia-Boston games in those days were big deals. But in this particular series now, remember, the Celtics had not won since Russell. And now here's Bird, and Philadelphia had beaten them in five games the year before. And now they're up 3-1 and up by 6 points with 1:40 left in overtime in Boston. And the Celtics came back and won the game. And then they went on to win 3 games. And the seventh game was in Boston. It was as emotional. That building was rocking, like unbelievable. And it was just an emotional, incredible game. And the big play in the game came with 1 minute to go, and the score tied. And Dawkins went up for a shot, and I think he was fouled, but they didn't call it. And Bird got the rebound, and he came down the left side of the court. And I know people here listening to me will remember it. And all of a sudden, he pulled up from like 17 and banked it in from the left. He wasn't a banker. I never saw him bank it before or since. And I've asked him about it, but why did he do it? He had no idea. He just did, and he banked it to put him up by two. And that was the winning basket. Maurice Checks got fouled, but he missed 1 or 2 free throws, and the Celtics were able to run out the clock and win that game. But that building, and after the game, people were congregating outside in a way that they never did. I never saw any other time greeting the team. And that was an incredibly emotional game. I wouldn't mind reliving that day.
Well, this article is a reminder of what we love so much about sport, that when you walk into a stadium, into an arena, you don't know what's going to happen. Then there's always the possibility of something great, something unforgettable, or something you've never seen before happening.
Well, you're so right, and this is why I get bristle every time people say, oh, it's just entertainment. No, entertainment E is something else, and it's generally scripted. But sports are not scripted. That's the ultimate separation thing, is that you don't know who's going to win. You don't know, and you don't know when something spectacular and historic will happen. Therefore, that just is different. I want both things in my life. I want books. I want movies. I want theater. I want art. But the one that is special because it is absolutely not scripted, and you don't know, and it has that wonderful aura of uncertainty, and it's sports. And if you don't have sports in your life, you are missing something. I think you're missing something if you have all those other things in your life too. But so many times people are condescending about sports when in fact it can be an incredible and uplifting experience.
Of all the places you've visited outside of New England and your normal journeys, where would you most like to go back and make a return visit?
Oh, you mean outside the U.S.?
Outside the U.S. or even just outside of New England.
Oh, okay. Well, interesting. I would like to go back to, wake up at one of the some rockin' Big Five night in the Palestra. You know, I'd like that. You know, I'll never forget when I was a junior, BC. We had a great team at BC, and I was at the game. They played St. Joe's, and the first game of the doubleheader. What happens? You play the first game, and then a Big Five game is the second game, and it was Temple LaSalle, and BC's beaten St. Joe's, and with about 5 minutes to go, the crowd starts getting into it, and the Temple crowd starts chanting on one side, and the LaSalle crowd's chanting on the other side, and meanwhile, the other game's going on, and And they're saying, well, we had enough of this one. We're waiting for our boys to take the floor. But that's, and there's a lot of, I'll tell you, I'd like to go back to Tiger Stadium and see a baseball game and sit in that the greatest seat I ever saw had in baseball was upper deck in Tiger Stadium. I can tell you the truth that you could hear the voices. We paid a visit, weekend visit to Tiger Stadium when they closed that ballpark in '99, and I had seats in the upper deck behind first base, and you could hear the voices of the umpire and the first base coach and the runner. That's how close you were to that field. There'll never be another opportunity like that in any baseball stadium anywhere.
Now, I'm looking at the chart of all the states and what you've seen for events. Do you remember the four states you've seen horse racing in?
Yeah, well, it's funny. You know, that's one of them, of course, is Buck, but I had forgotten about that. And what happened was about last month I was in Los Angeles, and we're driving down the street, and I said, oh, my God, that's where Hollywood Park was. I forgot. And I remembered I hadn't included horse racing in my story. I'd already written the story. And so I said, and on top of that, I've been to Suffolk Downs. And on top of that, I've been to Pimlico. And on top of that, I've been to Wonderland for dog racing. And I've been to Bay State Raceway for harness. I forgot all about them. And this happened a lot, Rich. I would remember things after the fact. And so I was filling in new things over the last couple of weeks. But, yes, but there's one other thing, and today, and here's, you'll love this one. Today, in the email, I got an email from a guy saying, you know, I'm wondering why you didn't mention that you had ever gone to a Kentucky Derby, or you did mention the Pimlico, so you must have gone to a Preakness. I said, oh, my God, I forgot. I've been to three Belmonts. and I'd never been to a Triple Crown race because I only went to the three Belmonts when there was an opportunity for a Triple Crown, you know. And that was three times that I was sent to New York to do the Belmont. So I had to add them today. And I thank this emailer for contributing to my story because I had actually forgotten I'd been to three Belmonts.
And how many Olympics have you covered through the years?
11, 6 summer and 5 winter. So there's 9 countries there involved because 2 of the Olympics were American. Of course, the Atlanta in 1996 and Salt Lake City in 2002. So and I've been to 4 provinces in Canada for athletic events. The most interesting one being Halifax, Nova Scotia, where I saw a Celtics-Knicks exhibition circa 1971. So, Canada, I got, and of course I've got Vancouver, and I've got Quebec naturally with Montreal, and Ontario, of course, with Toronto.
Well, it is such a wonderful piece. It reminds us about what we love about sport and in the TV age when people can sit back and watch games on their phone or some small device. It also serves to remind that there's nothing better than seeing live sports in person, walking into those hot, steamy arenas on a winter's night or on a beautiful baseball diamond on a summer's day.
Well, and I want to add, my next quest is get college basketball venue number 206. I hit 205 with South Dakota State. Now it's ready. Let's go for 206.
We're looking forward to it, Bob. It's a great piece. It's online right now at bostonglobe.com, or you can read it the old-fashioned way, the way I still like to, in the print edition coming up this weekend. Bob, thank you so much for being with us.
Oh, thanks for having me. I really appreciate it, Rich.
Bob Ryan of the Boston Globe with us here on Dan.